seizure, mistreatment, dispossession, assessment, lien, or other infringement of a personal or property right, or two, deny or impede another in the exercise or enjoyment of any right, privilege, power, or immunity secured by law.
This has got some civil ramifications too, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This has some civil ramifications.
Roger, the thing that concerns me...
This could be characterized as civil rights criminal statute.
The thing that concerns me about this is that not infrequently in the criminal cases, you have a person who has been subjected to an illegal search, which where you prevail in the motion to suppress. And these people are crying for to sue the police for false arrest or whatever. Putting this into the statute just makes it that much easier.
Not going to come in there. With knowledge that his conduct is illegal.
Well, wouldn't it be creating a jury question? You knew Sheriff Clark, didn't you? Did you have probable cause to conduct that arrest?
Yes, I thought I did.
Did you know you didn't have probable cause? No, I didn't know that. Here's
your jury question.
Here's your jury question.
Read the first two paragraphs of commentary before you go on. Senator Burns, be persuaded. Doesn't have any high-flowing things in there about the sanctity of the marriage contract or anything.
Are you going to make the move all second?
Mr. Chairman, if I can be any help, if you think this is troublesome, wait till you get to sections 5 and 6.
Well,
yes,
that'll
help. Okay.
Now, this is my penal code.
Yes.
By golly, there are so many times where a police officer is called upon on the spur of the moment to make a decision with respect to a search, with respect to an arrest,
If he does it with knowledge that his conduct is illegal,
that's a jury question, though, and all you got to do is go back to the cabin and say, well, you were had 3 hours on search and seizure, and you heard about the Miranda warnings and all this other kind of stuff, and you heard of Knapp and all these cases, and yet you took this confession and seized that property, et cetera, et cetera. I think he's guilty. The jury is going to say he's been trained. He should have known.
In addition to that, the quality of the police officers in proof committee were taking college courses, 2-year degrees.
So they're not going to be doing things with knowledge that their conduct is illegal.
Sometimes in the space of 2 seconds when the decision has to be made, that they don't have time to refer to their textbooks.
Why? Well, expect to refer to their textbooks. If they referred to their textbooks, then they would know that their conduct was illegal.
Well, of course, that's easy to say, but
it's not true in practice.
But the fact of business is that I would say that perhaps 1 out of 20 arrests where the officer doesn't use his card, he will give a faulty Miranda warning. I must say I hate to see that to be the basis for a criminal prosecution. And I suppose the chance that it would be relatively small as long as the DA had to get along somewhat with the police, but I kind of hate to see it written in.
I don't see how that, as I read this thing, that he would have to decide in advance that he was going to do this, knowing that it was illegal. Not a question of a spur of the moment decision on a Miranda warning.
Prosecutor's invitation to you.
Well,
how about using the word maliciously?
Oh, here we go again.
That is
one of our words that isn't, we don't use.
Might go back and take a look at the definitions.
Oh, they got this cute thing. They don't read. Let's read the definitions. So we approved all the stuff. You know.
No, we're not trying to be cute, Mr. Chairman.
In fact, I have all the definitions right here. Look at
them. How would that be?
That's
certainly colorful.
That's as plain as the language in our obscenity statute.
You'd have to define pedigree.
Does mistreatment mean physically?
No.
Well, couldn't it be mentally? Shouldn't
well,
that
they harass the hell out of the guy. That's
well, subject matter to harass, detention, search, seizure, mistreatment.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Whatever reason he is, you've got a picture of misconduct in 2 degrees.
Give it to Bruce, he's the one who needs it.
Yeah?
In a way, it really covers what we're talking about here without going into the system.
Don, did you answer that?
Performs an act, unauthorized and unauthorized exercise of official duties, isn't that applied to a certain seizure situation or an arrest?
I would think.
Without getting ourselves in this morass?
No, there's some overlap, aren't you?
Knowingly or with knowledge means that a person acts with an awareness that his conduct is of a nature so described or that a circumstance so described exists. And I think you're going to have a hard time being inadvertently knowingly.
On page 14 of this three-page society, I'm giving examples of people that were public servants who were convicted of the official oppression statute. And I think I would agree that under all three of those cases, they could have been charged under official misconduct.
Is it possible to just do away with official, whatever it is, oppression?
Mr. Chairman, I move we delete section 4.
Second.
Oh!
You heard the motion.
What a whitewash!
Well, Mr. Chairman, before we take a vote on we got a good subcommittee working on this. I wonder if we can.
Where's the chairman of the subcommittee here?
Defend himself.
Where'd he go?
Why isn't there on the phone?
They
got to
defend yourself. They're about to
throw out.
Ken,
you'll
be in right now.
I'm on that, but that I wasn't on the committee.
Well, Jeff, the House of Christ, give us
no
responsibility.
No, exactly.
I took four.
Yeah,
I don't know.
How far does this go beyond the ORS sections that are cited?
I got
one letter. From the two presidents.
Well, those ORS sections aren't really directly employed.
510 relates to unlawful act or omission. It relates more to section 3, 141.730.
Those are search warrants.
Relates to, an order for the interception of communication.
Yeah, right.
And 090 relates to warrant, search warrant. And 740 relates to confidential records, but I don't know what's 421.
That relates to violence and injury to penitentiary inmates.
Well, why do we really have to have this section 4 at all?
I'm persuaded that we don't.
Well, but the subcommittee we're having.
Well, we think there really.
I think there was a subcommittee. We had it probably.
Yeah, we did. We had Chairman Carson was there and representing office.
So,
could you answer that question?
Attorney General Johnson was there, but he was delayed. I'm not sure he was present at the time of word on that.
Well, I think there's a constitutional present for the question with respect to the matter being in front of the committee.
Well, Clarence here, that'd be a lot safer ground to kick it out, I can assure you.
Well, it just seems to me that most of the stuff that's covered by this, we have covered elsewhere.
I don't know.
And the statutes that are listed here, the ORS sections, under as existing law, really don't have a great deal of, I don't think,
great deal to do with what we're talking with about in section four, because they'll be covered elsewhere anyway.
What's 105?
And we're really opening the gate here.
That's the only one not covered under existing laws.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand where we'd cover this matter under
I would suggest this morning, the official misconduct, public service.
Look at the existing law citations under the one that was just passed. We find that 4, 5, 10, 7, 30, 10, 7, 30, and 105 are covered in the existing law under official misconduct. The only exception being 421-105.
Yeah, of course, it's somewhat misleading because one of our problems with our criminal statute, sometimes we don't talk about this one subject. And this, I can't disagree with the danger.
This, as I read it, is really a third gradation of the same basic offense, a lesser offense than section two is a failure to perform. Section 3 is a performance of an act that's going to hurt somebody or that's going to fail to carry out his oath of office. And Section 4 is official oppression, and it exists. And it's bad business.
Well, look at subsection 2. We have a lot of civil rights problems or anything. Don't you think that this is an invitation to a great many charges being leveled at public servants of one category or another under subsection 2 by the assertion of the complainant on the ground that a particular public servant did something which denied or impeded the complainant in the exercise or enjoyment of some right, privilege, power, or immunity? Now, right and privilege, the enjoyment of any right and privilege, this can go helter-skelter in all directions and could really be an invitation to a lot of friendly problems.
Well, in mine also, Chairman, furnish a civil remedy under the line of cases which suggests that where there's a penal statute intended for the protection of a particular class, violation of it carries with it a corresponding civil right.
False imprisonment, false arrest.
Well, under your civil rights acts, under your securities acts, and a number of areas where that's true.
Wally, what do you
Well, about the only thing I could add, and I don't really know how persuasive it is, since or because we've left in harm to others in the preceding statute, but from the minister recalls, we fought the same ground that we're fighting now, without much more success than we're having now. The difference between, as Roger explained, the difference between section 3 and 4, the one we just passed and this one, is that we did have the requirement in 3 to the intent to obtain a benefit for himself or to harm another, whereas the official oppression section requires only that he knows the statute is illegal. He need not prove that he was going to put money in his own pocket or take money out of anybody else's pocket.
It doesn't require any statute under this. He has knowledge that his conduct is illegal.
That's why I say that's the difference, one of the major differences. For instance, I understood you to say that this is covered elsewhere, and it is pretty well covered. If he's doing the same act to obtain the benefit for himself or harm somebody else, then pretty much is covered. But if you can't prove he's going to get any benefit himself, you know, the sheriff, who's playing pretty heavy on the black, prove that he's getting any personal benefit, or if you can't prove that he's doing it to harm the black, then he's not under Section 3.
Well, if he is doing it, he either is or isn't doing it to harm the block.
But the question of proving it, I think we've got lots of statutes that are a little less harsh just because you can't prove one element of the thing and you can prove something being manslaughter, murder, delinquency.
Are you ready to vote on this?
Well, I can see the park official they boot somebody out of the park and then they goes to court later and they rule that he couldn't speak for the Board of County Commissioners or something like that, and the guy is
Did he know that the conduct was illegal?
No, if he knew that conduct was illegal, yes.
Well, maybe he knew that he hadn't really been invested with that power, but he thought it was the right thing to do at the time.
Well, and that's bad business.
Don, if this were in effect now, you wouldn't last out your term. This section here. Really, it opens up Pandora's box.
I agree.
None of us would.
I can see the other.
I don't have any term, so it doesn't bother me.
You're ready to vote, we'll call the question. Call the roll to delete section four.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Nope.
Chandler.
Nope.
Clark.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Jernstad.
Aye.
Waddell.
Aye.
Knight. Spalding.
No.
Young.
No.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. What's the count?
You just divided the office holders from the citizens.
Motion is carried.
Mr. Chairman, I want to.
Pathetic, but I'm afraid it's going to.
I want to take up the Model Agnew statute on the press now.
You're out of order. Section five.
We rezoned section four.
Yeah.
This was a new law for Oregon. Misuse of confidential information. Public servant commits the crime of misuse of confidential information if in contemplation of official action by himself or by a governmental unit with which he is associated, or in reliance on information to which he has access in an official capacity and which has not been made public, he acquires or aids another in acquiring a pecuniary interest in any property, transaction, or enterprise which may be affected by such information or official.
If he knows that the
courthouse
is going to be built and some fix or something, and he tells somebody, you know, you better buy that land next to it.
This was suggested by the Model Municipal Code in a section called speculating or wagering on official action or information. And it was adopted by Michigan.
Do you want to mention the fact that we knocked down subsection 3 of the original? Do you want to get into that? I don't have the other drafts.
Jackson?
I'm sending out them off to Judge Donald and some of the commissioners.
We'll be renumbered number 4 and pass it to the draft.
Motion is that section 5 be renumbered as section 4 and that it be passed as section 4. Is there a second?
Chairman.
Judge Burns.
What is the meaning of the phrase which has not been made public?
He ain't told no one.
How do you make something public?
By telling
by an announcement. For official announcement.
That's the best one.
In other words, if the county commissioners go out and drive around and make it Deschutes County, and they decide they're going to change the road up here, and then before they've gone back and had their meeting on the subject, the county judge, now called county commissioner, goes out and buys the property, that's at that point. But
or he has his friend or his uncle.
Yeah. Now if they decide that they go back to the courthouse and have a court meeting and record it in the minutes, and the county clerk takes it down, and then he rushes out and buys it, that's not quite as bad.
Would this be better if we said, which has not been publicly announced?
Mm-hmm. No, it'd be probably the same thing.
I think so.
A lot of things in public record the public doesn't know about.
Yeah, they don't problem. Pay attention to them, but they are there for those who are interested.
Well, I have some doubt that I put it this way. I think a commentary on what we mean by made public is there's a lot of governmental activity that
take your various advisory committees and so on, that need to state by them and all the way through. Is it enough that the action is done at a meeting which is at least theoretically open? Does that make it public?
I would certainly think so.
Yeah, I don't see that you can say that there have to be 10 people there before it's public.
Or the press has to cover it.
Or that the newspaper reporter has to be there. Or anything else, I think.
I think you stated it well.
At a meeting and the action's recorded in the official records of the body, well, I think that's public.
Well, must it be recorded in the minutes of the group?
I would say no, because there are many actions taken by county courts particularly, which are not entered in the minutes.
Not in our county, there aren't any more.
Well, there aren't most of them. You folks keep an eye on them. Any meeting which is open to the public at which any action is taken and announced is made. It could be that there's only one person there.
Well, maybe nobody. Maybe nobody. It would be true in a great number of meetings, there wouldn't be anybody there.
But there could be. Yes.
Yeah.
It's open to the public.
It's open to those who want it.
Yeah.
Well, as long as either the minutes or the commentary show that broad meaning in that phrase.
Would you show that in the commentaries?
Well, would it ruin the act to leave out that phrase, and which has not been made public?
Well, you're broadening it.
I know.
Then you have a meeting.
Well, then it would
and
be
they may take an action, and then a month later, the county judge's neighbor goes out and buys the thing, and then you've got to put him under a cloud that he really doesn't belong under.
Well, then it wouldn't be misuse of confidential information.
No.
Well, I'd say then it certainly would be confidential, because it hadn't been made public, nobody knows about it yet, and he goes out and takes action that benefits him.
All right, you inquired, Bruce, as to whether or not we should strike the word which has not been made public.
I don't think we should strike that, because that's the time element that determines when it loses its confidentiality.
Right.
Plus, you would be preventing an individual, merely because he's a public servant, from really doing a legitimate act, investing in property or something. And so long as there's no overreaching involved or.
He gets there first, but the most is.
Any further discussion? Call roll.
What's the motion?
To adopt section, renumber it, and approve it. And if you don't mind, include it in the same motion, assuming this will pass, I hope. We passed section 2, but we didn't officially pass it. So this will also be to approve section 2, was it amended?
Well, I have doubts as to.
As
I
amended.
Think that Ted Burns raised it. Good technical point. I don't think there's any definition of what's been made public. I don't think there's any definition of what's confidential.
Well, our commentary is going to show what's been made public.
I see. Okay.
Anything that hasn't been made public is confidential.
Anything that's confidential.
Or at very least inside information.
Clay Martin.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Carr.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Jernstead.
Aye.
O'Dell.
Aye.
Nye. Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Section 6, numbered section 5.
We spend a lot of time on section 6, and it has been redrafted.
Trying to cut our heads, gentlemen.
I think since they saw it.
Maybe I better read this one.
And it's kind of long and involved, but here you go.
You're serious about this, aren't you?
What?
No, he's joking.
A public servant commits the crime of concealing a conflict of interest. if he exercises a substantial discretionary function in connection with a pecuniary transaction involving the government and fails to disclose in advance a known potential conflicting interest in the transaction to either the Attorney General or District Attorney of the county wherein he resides.
Wait.
But that's just the start.
Go pass any judgment.
When disclosure is made to the district attorney, he shall, as soon as practicable, request the Attorney General for an opinion as to whether a conflict of interest exists.
And he relates to the district attorney.
I'll be back.
A potential conflicting interest exists when the public servant A is a director, officer, or high managerial agent of the private entity involved in the transaction, or B owns or controls a substantial pecuniary interest in the private entity involved in the transaction, or three is related by consanguinity or marriage to a person who is a director, officer, or high managerial agent, or who owns, I've added who, which is not in this case, or who owns or controls a substantial pecuniary interest in the private entity involved in the transaction.
What does substantial mean?
That's what we spend a lot of time talking about.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be mighty helpful if we had a 5-minute recess and let everybody take a red pencil and go through and pick out the vague words, because this is the problem we have with the statute. There's some lulus in here as far as it might take you 15.
3A is what we know as the Bill Machowski.
Of course, in your other relationships, like substantial evidence.
Yeah. And I think substantial interest has too.
Mr. Chairman, does this relate to, like, on the floor of either the House or Senate, voting on the issue?
Is our public servants exclude, our legislators excluded from the definition of public servants?
No, I don't think so.
It would.
There she goes, down the tube.
Well, wait a minute. Now, I want to raise the question by declaring that I have a conflict of interest in the thing, and then by saying I'm not going to vote, by that's just the same as casting a no vote.
No. In this case, I think you declare that you had a conflict and then vote your conscience.
Yeah.
Okay. The conflict
I got
no.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Say that again.
You declare that you have a possible conflict and then vote. Cast your vote your conscience.
You
one is the conflict is known.
One is the conflict is known. Why, that's nothing wrong with exercising your discretionary function as a
All right.
As
would
a
he
public
have,
official.
Would that legislator then have to disclose to the district attorney, who in turn will go to the Attorney General?
No, he just disclosed to the Attorney General in the first place.
The
Attorney General will have a staff man at all the voting sessions of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman. We had a little bill in front of the Commerce and Utilities Committee, of which you were an eminent member, the last session. It related to gasoline games at camps, and consumers wanted to do away with these giveaway games, and apparently the gasoline companies wanted to continue them as a merchandising thing. I was chairman of the committee. I think we tabled one of the bills and we voted the other one down or something. It occurred to me 2 months later, when somebody was discussing conflict of interest, that I owned some stock in an oil company, Gulf Oil. I hadn't even thought anything about it at the time we were deliberating these bills. However,
middle name Hainsworth.
However, I'd be guilty under this, wouldn't I? If I failed to disclose, because it's possible that there's a...
No, I wouldn't. I don't think so.
Is it knowingly against?
It's not substantial.
That's right, Dave.
And no, I mean, here, Gulf Oil's got 6 million shares outstanding.
Yeah, but it's based on the weight of the individual situation, not of Gulf Oil.
No, well, substantial is in connection with a function that's exercised, not the interest.
Yeah.
He exercises a substantial discretionary.
Look at 3B.
Substantial pecuniary interest would be a substantial chunk of Gulf Oil, not whether you put all your chips into 10 shares of Gulf Oil at 30 and a quarter.
But look at page 22 that says this problem has not been resolved, whether it's objective.
Well, it will be in our minutes.
If a
member of Board of County Commissioners is in some kind of business
and he is selling something to those people who are also before him on planning matters, would that be covered under the statute?
Well, I'll tell you what's covered in the present statute. You know, these things are, this is not new law in many respects. I'm the subject of an attorney general's opinion in this state because my wife bought some stock in a company, but a friend wanted to start with short of capital, and she put in $3,000 because it was not particularly substantial as far as she was concerned, but was reasonably substantial as far as he was concerned. He was bidding on some work from a school district, which I happen to be a board member. And one of the and he bid the thing, public bid, and opened it, and he won it on the low bid, and his bid was thrown out after complaint by the next low bidder, and the school district paid more money because I was married to her and she had an interest in it, and I was on the school board.
Is that uphill?
Hmm?
Is that uphill?
Nothing was done.
There's a federal statute on conflict of interest, which is pretty workable. But I don't see. At least I am unsuccessful in defending them. We got this bar from Judge Solomon's court for appealing on account of misconduct in the court.
This is called selective disbarment.
That's the tone of voice case, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the tone of voice.
Yeah.
In Ray Yates is the irascible tone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there should be something in this area in our law. We have a lot of ORS sections on it.
Well, as I recall, that federal statute, it doesn't draw the basis of concealing it. It's just acting while having a conflict of interest. As I recall, it's been quite a while since I looked at that.
What about a fellow who had $1 million worth of investment in mutual funds, which cover everything? He couldn't do a thing in the legislature, could he?
Yeah.
No, I don't think he'd have any particular problem
but
at all.
He had to
because
give the DA a package, his billfold, I mean his portfolio.
His connection would be so tenuous, though, with any of the individual companies involved in that mutual fund. So far removed, no ability to vote the stock or have any control over the mutual fund, owned it or sold it.
Yeah, but that conflict of interest should relate to the interest as it applies to the actor.
Well,
it affects his vote or his exercise of his discretion.
Well, but it should apply to the company in which he owns an interest, because if his interest, whether it's big to him or not, is so small it can have no effect on the price of the stock or the fortune of the company, then you're talking about if a bottler in Hood River owns some stock in a Coca-Cola company, and the Coca-Cola board of directors is going to split the stock, and he's going to vote against something down here, he's going to want a hell of a lot of it before he has any effect on the board of directors.
The roughness of it, and where the public gets deprived of the benefit of his sincere exercise of his duty, is the interest is important to him.
Now the corruptness, whether it has a chance
of being successful or not. In that case, I have the head of the Commodity Credit Corporation in Oregon, the federal government, made a deal with my client for my client to get a warehouse to store wheat. And the head of the Commodity Credit Corporation decided where wheat would be stored, and it was a hell of a profitable business storing wheat. And so my guy got the warehouse, and sure enough, he got the contract to store all of the wheat came this way and kept his warehouse full when nobody else could get any business out of the government. and that wasn't very important to the United States government, that much that was paid this guy in this particular warehouse, but it did deprive the government of the benefit of the services of that Commodity Credit Corporation guy.
I don't think.
I mean, I'm assuming everybody was guilty, as the jury said they were, and That was the charge that was made.
I don't think the interest of the government is paramount. I think whether the guy's actions can have any influence on the outcome, on the actions of either the government or the corporation. In this case, it certainly had influence on the actions of the government.
I think
it was the controlling factor, and so it would be.
Well, this relates only to matters where this discretionary function is in connection with pecuniary transactions that involve the government.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're overlooking something, and that is that what we're trying to do, well, first of all, this is concealing a conflict of interest. And a conflict of interest successfully concealed is not actionable, logically, unknown. Mm-hmm. I assume. So what we're really talking about is conflicts of interest, with being harmful to public good.
Yeah.
We're back again to Section 2 on official misconduct, except for the discretionary question. It's the only difference I see. Because you still have the benefit or the benefit to you that pecuniary, I assume, would be included in that. And sub 2 of Section 3 says he knowingly performs an act constituting an unauthorized exercise of his official duty. I don't think anybody would successfully argue that doing something for yourself is part of your authorized duty. Not authorized, therefore it's unauthorized, therefore it's unlawful, and covered by Section 3.
You have to show that that's the reason he did it.
Well, knowingly performs an act, that's the unauthorized exercise of official duty.
Yeah, but see.
The benefit to me is not my
fault. I'm a member of the Board of County Good Commissioners of Multnomah County. I've got a planning matter before me. I go out to the guy's house that this planning matter is coming for, and I sell him something. I say, I'm selling these set of encyclopedias, and I think you ought to buy one. And he said, well, yeah, I think I probably should buy one of those. Right? I sell him that and set aside fees. Next day I go on his thing. That's a conflict of interest.
No, that's not a conflict of interest.
There it is.
Bribery.
There it
is. Corruption of honor.
I think what we're talking about really in this whole article is whether or not people have a right to demand that their people they place in office, either through election or appointment by their elected representatives, a higher standard of conduct than they demand of anybody else. Of anybody else. Higher standard of conduct than they demand of the family minister or anybody else. Now, they've got no other place to turn than this guy. If their lawyer is crooked, they can go get another lawyer. If their legislator is crooked, they can't go and claim the legislator in the next district as their own, or the state senator in the next county, or the county commissioner in the next.
You can in Multnomah County, they don't have single member districts.
Well,
very good point. Where's John?
But I think they've got a right to demand, expect and demand an exceptionally high standard of conduct from people that hold a life or death power over them almost in the cases of what they can do, a regulation of their personal activities, of their businesses, of their whole range of daily and annual activities.
Oh, that's right, but why punish concealing? Punish the conflict of interest. Punish the bad act.
No.
Because, as I say, if it's successfully concealed, it's not actionable.
Well,
if he's unsuccessful, his conflict of interest has come to light and punish it.
Why?
One of the problems we ran into with what constitutes a conflict of interest is very easy to resolve afterwards, as the Haynesburg case demonstrates. And I'm sorry that we should have available here what we had to work on, which went a lot further than this did, and perhaps was better, but certainly got the area there. One of the things that Roger had to do, and Bob has indicated earlier, and that is that this is and you're talking to the point, this is a reporting and concealing, declaring. This is what you do on the floor when you say, I have a potential conflict of interest. My firm has represented this matter in some other time. Then go ahead and vote your conscience. This is what we're getting at. The problem is that, of course, maybe we need another statute that says that if you have a conflict of interest, you must remove yourself from deliberation, which is perhaps getting to the point of selling encyclopedias the night before. But we're trying to let the public in on what the potential conflict of interests are. Now, I agree with you that maybe we're circumventing the thing, the thrust, and that is to stop conflict of interest. But that's so doggone hard, as we've demonstrated here. Take the Haynesworth thing, a $16,000 investment in a portfolio to Haynesworth and Brunswick were nothing. But to Carson in Brunswick would have been, you couldn't get much more substantial than a $16,000 investment by me. And so you'd have to go after the fact, and you allow the jury and everybody else to debate the question as we did.
In either case, $16,000 out of Brunswick, $60 million worth of, or $600 million worth of invested market value of a company stock is nothing. I don't think there's anything wrong with it in today's society where everybody has got some interest. I suspect everybody around this room has got some life insurance. And so as a result, you're a mortgage holder in Deschutes County, and you're an investor in the Brunswick company, and you're this, that, and the other thing. I don't think it's possible for any human being not to have some potential conflict. And I mean, a guy's going to have to, you can't even do it, invest in government bonds. Or not buying life insurance. And the real problem on it is so that the people who are expected at the polls or otherwise to judge your conflict, your conduct, know in advance before you make whatever, before you take whatever official action you're going to take, that, that that possibility exists, and that your vote might have been thereby influenced.
Let me ask you this question, if that is what your purpose is the DA or the Attorney General, does either one of those officials have any duty of disclosure? Let us say...
Yeah, they're public servants.
Well, no, wait a minute. Let's say that Dave Frost gets a hold of Lee Johnson in the middle of the next session and says, I own 100 shares of XYZ Corporation and I'm getting ready to vote on Senate Bill 2843. Do I have a conflict of interest? And Lee Johnson says yes or no, whatever it is. Where does that correspondence repose thereafter?
Well, that's the thing that disturbs me in this whole thing. Number one.
Well, the point I make, though, is that Bob is making speeches here. I desire to point out that they're as sanctimonious as the commentary that he was criticizing earlier, perhaps even more sanctimonious. and he's talking about the people knowing about it, but this doesn't say a word about it. This says that Lee Johnson or George Van Hoomison knows about it. Now, but it doesn't say that either one of them has any duty or even right to disclose that.
And it doesn't even, beyond that, all he has to do is to disclose that, request an opinion, then it doesn't say how he can vote or how he can exercise his deal. Where does it say it?
That's right, it doesn't.
In the hopes of further compounding this thing or in the realization, let me add also that it doesn't refer only to elected officials.
No.
And as a matter of fact, one of the great things that access, if you will, that I have in here is to the appointed or civil servant that is now, we're easy, elected are easy to get to, and the public trust and all that sort of stuff. It's the guy that's granting contracts in general services, and this is the guy that nobody can get at unless they can catch him with his hand in the till. The second thing is, really, the original draft had such things as disclosed to the public or to your immediate superior. Now, if you'd like to try that on for a while, which might solve your problem, what, you know, so your immediate superior sits on it. Or, as I indicated, so you tell Floyd McCain, he says, thanks. I mean, you tell the newspaper, you tell your wife. What is disclosure to the public, which gets back even worse to your point. You have to run an ad?
Announce it on TV.
Yes. Well, here's another one that bothers me. I could get up and have Bob write out my sanctimonious speech and declare all this interest and everything, and then say, I thereby refrain from voting on this measure and sit down, and the public claps and claps, but they don't stop to realize that that no vote might be just the same as a no vote in the way I want it to go anyway.
Well, that's true, too. But this thing here, why the district attorney and the attorney general?
Well, because there's an action taken, one of those people's going to have.
You can't
find
anybody else. You don't want to say you've got to put it in the Hudson River News.
All right, then shouldn't we go on and then say that if the attorney general says that there is a conflict of interest, that he should not exercise this discretionary function?
Right.
This simply says that he asks for an opinion.
Then you're gonna have the attorney general making the purchasing decisions to the school board in Deschutes County.
Sure you are, and this applies to public servants, which covers the whole gambit.
Give him the right of appeal from the attorney general's opinion.
Well, what if you're going to vote on whether a sewer is built or not built, and you own a house in the area to be served by the sewers? That's certainly going to be covered.
Well,
Well, if it's substantial, it should be disclosed. Contact the Attorney General, who in turn will contact the District Attorney, who in turn will contact the Attorney General, and when you get his opinion, the sewer's built. And you go to jail.
You have a problem. The Attorney General can also have a similar conflict of interest.
That's right.
He goes to the coroner.
It's presupposed there's no conflict on the part of the Attorney General, which may or may not be true.
What if a Board of County Commissioners, and one of them, of course, under this, it wouldn't be adequate, but if he has a conflict of interest and he discloses it to them completely, and they say, well, that's all right, Joe, it doesn't make any difference, go ahead and vote on it anyway. Okay, and he does. Someone comes along later and he disclosed it, and there'll be a difference of opinion as to whether or not his conflict was a substantial one, and you're getting a lot of hot water. And still we should have something in this area on our statute books.
Well, rather than approach it from a standpoint of concealing it, why not of disclosing a conflict of interest? And disclosure would be dependent upon the forum you're in. The legislature, I suppose, is announcing it. Or your purchasing man is writing a memo to your superior or somebody, I don't know. I mean, that's a problem. But the idea of concealing, to me, is just exactly the wrong way to go about it. If we're talking about disclosure, let's say disclosure.
Failure to disclose.
Yeah, failure to disclose.
Well, I think that the discretionary functions in state lifeguards are exercised by two groups of people. One are the elected, everybody from the legislators to the judges to the city commissioners to the school board members, and there must be 5,000 elected officials in the state, one kind or another. And in my opinion, the disclosure there should be made to the governing body of the group on which you're sitting, whether it's the chairman and secretary of the school board, or the speaker of the house, or the president of the senate, or whatever. Then you have probably 30,000 people who are involved in exercising discretion, making discretionary decisions, who are either appointed or civil service people, who have no body except an immediate superior. This is the one that would be difficult to. I have no problem with the legislator making an announcement or telling the speaker, you know, putting a little form in the speaker's office. I've got a conflict come up on SB 205, whatever it is. Or the school board member saying before the printing thing is up, my wife won't stock in that printing company.
Regulations of insurance companies by somebody who works for an insurance company. Anything to do with the bar by, or anything to do with how have court reporting as to the bar, fees paid to the county clerk.
I watched Howard Morgan, when he was appointed the public utilities commissioner in this state, try to sit down with his wife and decide who owned what, and what he was going to be in, what he might or might not be in trouble with in the regulation of utilities in the state, some stocks they own, but some property they own. It's a real problem, and people can have lots of them to handle. But I still think that we're going to have to face up to it, work it out something.
Bob, what would you say if the county's working on a road project, and they tell the foreman, county courts approve this, and they instruct the foreman to buy some gravel to repair a certain road, and there are four or five sand and gravel outfits, and so he goes over to his brother's, who has a place like that, and buys this gravel, $500 worth, from his brother, and say he has a half interest in it. Now, does that fellow have to write to go to the district attorney, and who in turn goes to the attorney general before the county can have this gravel so it can be put on these roads?
In my opinion, he shouldn't buy it from that gravel producer. If he's got a half interest in it, he should be practically.
All right, but my point is,
from dealing with
under this, should he go to the district attorney and disclose?
Yes.
And then he goes to the attorney general.
Yeah, and the DA says, yeah, I think you've got a conflict.
And then what?
And then he goes ahead and buys it anyway.
Yeah. There's no penalty.
As I recall, it used to be, maybe they still do it, at the end of the month, everything that Harney County Court bought, they ran a list of in the paper.
Newspaper Publishers Associations.
of which I'm not a member of.
One of the deals.
Only one in the state.
But, so you knew exactly how much...
You're a national officer or something, aren't you?
Bob, this guy doesn't own a half interest. It's his brother or brother-in-law that owns this gravel deal. What then?
Or his girlfriend.
He shouldn't. If there are other sources, and the price is relatively the same, he's got this kind of...
What if it isn't?
If there are no other sources...
If the price is less, and there are other sources.
And I think that his superiors ought to be able to approve his purchase. I think he'd have to go to the county court and get approval, because he says, I can get it from this guy for $10.
County court couldn't approve it under this. What they would have to do is say, all right, Joe, what we'll do is you forget about this gravel. John, you go buy it. Get somebody else.
Yeah,
that'd be easy enough to do, or they could approve it. Of course, there's nothing to stop them from approving it, if the conflict is made known, or the potential.
Let's think about this until our next meeting.
Yeah, it might be wise. Don, you and Roger may have something to say, after which we'll take a 15-minute recess.
Well, I'd like to point out this, that if this section was drawn from the Michigan Code, and now Michigan law has something in it that we don't have. They have a counterpart, and apparently a rather complicated law, because they mention it in their commentary. They say that the complexity of the issue is recognized by Michigan's newly adopted conflict of interest law, adopted in 1966, which provides a special procedure for obtaining advisory opinions as to potential conflict of interest situations. The remedy afforded by that law, namely making the contract subject to being voided by the state agency, plus possible non-criminal disciplinary action provided by other provisions, such as removal from office, should be entirely satisfactory in most instances. The committee did feel, however, that if a public servant knows that he has a possible conflict of interest in a situation, he should at least disclose this information in advance. So, I think that they were looking at this really as complementary to this law that they had with respect to...
Of course, see, their statute also says public disclosure includes public announcement or notification to a superior officer or the attorney general.
Why don't we have a filing of financial...
Great, I'll go for it. Full and complete statements on the bank's form every year, 1st of January.
Sure.
By whom?
By everybody.
By everybody who...
Everybody who's employed by or...
Public service.
Every public servant.
But the point I was trying to make is that perhaps this is an area that is better dealt with civil law rather than
Well, that's exactly what was in my mind.
I don't think so. I think the guy who's going to object and the little guy who's going to object isn't going to have the resources or the willingness to spend his money to go after the thing in the civil courts. And it's a public problem, and the public ought to prosecute.
Or should we have it apply only to elected and appointed officials who are in a supervisory capacity of some sort? Does this cover everyone?
We're the easiest to get to.
Why not everyone? Yeah. Why not every civil servant has to file with the county clerk or whatever?
Well, and deprive the public of the use of a lot of people and
philosophical grounds about Big Brother.
There's a lot of
Don't
help
me
back. I'm in a business where you have to do that.
Anyway,
so it doesn't bother
me. So should we recess for 15 minutes? And spend a lot of outside assets.
The trouble is, it almost defies Section 5.
Six.
Oh, you're on 6?
No, it's Section 5.
It is 5. Number.
Yeah, it is 5.
Well, Bruce had an idea that... We thought maybe we should defer action on it and think about it and come back next meeting. Is that what you thought?
Yeah, well, I'm not adamant about it. Let's quit talking about it now anyway, yeah. One way or the other.
Well, that's all right.
What's wrong with it?
I'll lead it.
I don't know what the hell it means.
I think it's going to continue to defy definition. I think...
It's a worthy feel, and it's something that I wouldn't like to just kiss off without careful thought. Is the reason why you're just deferring it?
Well, let's defer it, maybe somebody will come up with something.
If you look on page 17, you'll find even if this were deleted, there still are many statutes in the regulatory code prohibiting the same type of conduct.
Well, and then it's wrong.
Specialized in public servant.
Well, the problem is it doesn't apply to all. Somebody has come up and said, school districts, you know, so school districts are fine, but somebody forgot the soil conservation district.
Well, this Senate Bill 36 that was passed in 1969 picks up public servants employed by every district.
Soil district is. Soil conservation district is covered.
How about the purchasing agent?
Think of one and then there's a dozen you don't think.
The right-of-way agent of the highway department. I'd like to have some, if we can, get some means of not just laying it over and thinking about it and coming back to the meeting later this month and saying, well, we all thought about it, we can't think anything, so we quit. Because I think that in the kind of climate we've got today and the way people tend to look upon their government, a good example, I think, is the big furor being raised this year about Census Bureau questions, which for all intents and purposes are the same Census Bureau questions were asked in 1960 and over which there was no howl raised at all, and now they've got a majority of the House of Representatives to raise hell about the Census Bureau questions. I think people are taking a far greater interest in their institutions and expecting at least the information being made available to them on the conduct of those institutions, whether they be the legislature, the school board, or what. And I think we're going to have to, I think any state which fails to have a strong conflict of interest statute that applies to every public servant in that state is not doing the job that the people of the state want and have a right to have.
Chairman, in view of the fact that this is based upon the Michigan Code, and in view of the fact that the Michigan Code depends upon the fact that they have a general conflict of interest law, and their criminal statute is intended to apply only to certain situations, I think it would be helpful if all of us could have a copy of the Michigan statute. See, it may be, for example, that we would conclude that the Michigan statute itself makes sense with either this added or maybe without this added. And I would suggest that we put this over until our next meeting, or let's say for a month. And in the meantime, we have the staff get copies and send them to every commission member of the Michigan statute.
Don't we have it right here?
That's just failure to disclose.
That's
failure
to disclose.
There's a civil one about the requirements.
Yeah, in other words, they have a conflict. Get the entire 1966 Act in Michigan, because they wrote their criminal statute in the light of the existence of their civil statute.
Well, okay. Judge Burns removed the staff. Distribute copies of the Michigan statute, and could you include in that the federal conflict of interest statute?
I would think so.
And have it distributed, and we'll bring this up at the next meeting. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 One thing, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me we might consider be thinking about as we look over those conflict of interest statutes. For example, in a legislative body, it seems to me that there should be a requirement to disclose a substantial conflict of interest. But at that point, once it has been disclosed, and I believe that's the rule now, that a majority vote of that body determines whether it is of such degree that that person should not vote on it.
Ah, it's unanimous consent.
Yes. Is it unanimous?
It's in the Senate too, constitutional.
Unanimous consent.
Well, we might give some thought to that in other
67. Monty declined to vote or got unanimous consent on an issue early in the session. The next day, staff Ansel got up and said, anybody who tries that again on this floor, I'll
respect my objection.
The second day of this session, 69.
That's true, it is require unanimous consent, I recall.
That's my constitution.
But in other bodies like county courts, you might have the same thing apply there. Those who are, so that the, if the other members unanimously consent, he can vote, let them be the judges of whether or not this is substantial, and then he escapes any possible prosecution or anything else. But there's a division between those who are exercising functions of that sort and those who are mere employees but are civil servants. And we should find some other way to handle them other than requiring them to go to the district attorney and et cetera. Perhaps their supervisors or superiors or something. But I think that this has resulted from an effort to put everything into one package and treat them all alike, and you can't treat them alike.
If the guy is actually gained an improper advantage out of it, then he's guilty of another crime anyway.
Or attempting to.
And so we're really talking about the existence of a set of circumstances. I've always wondered whether, the ultimate answer on this is the ballot box.
Why are you going to get to the ballot box on the county road supervisor? Or the highway department right away, like maybe a little farther away from the ballot box.
I second the motion.
It's already passed.
Now, let's want to move on to the next year. We'll be talking about that.
Yeah, so to speak.
Riots?
Tomorrow.
Well, why don't we move along a little bit? Maybe we can get through quicker tomorrow. Is it all right?
Yes, sir.
Is riot in our books?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Next red thing.
That starts on section 2.
No, I thought we might start with section 1 this time. Ordinary public. We really don't have much in the way of definitions here. And so we really, I think, should take them as we go along with the sections. So beginning on page 4, I think just as background before, I'll turn this back over to Roger here. Probably the areas, the two areas that gave the subcommittee the most difficulty and have given other states similar difficulty, this area of disorderly conduct and your so-called vagrancy statutes. And we've attempted to draft some constitutional statutes. I'm not so sure that that's possible, but probably section 6 on loitering is going to present the most difficulty.
Is that worse than Mr. Thornton's section on loitering that he was offering this morning?
No, it's not as bad. Well, I think I will hope there'll be considerable discussion on section 5. Yeah.
Don just tried to get on one. That's all.
So just with those
are we speaking plain areas we're going to fight? I'd like to
not a whole lot. And I there's one other thing I should mention, I think, before we start on any particular section, and that is that I've taken the liberty of including in your book an appendix dealing with the crime of treason. Now, this has not been through the subcommittee. The reason I put it in there is that it's the type of crime, it's provided for under our Constitution, a definition of treason. And originally, we had thought that our original outline of our tentative code provided for a separate article. But further examination and
the complete lack of any cases in this area. I think there have been about two prosecutions in the United States since 1800, or for state treason, that we felt that if the commission wanted to have a statutory crime of treason, in as much as most treason would be a federal offense, if you have treason against the state, it's probably in most instances going to amount to treason against the United States. But if you did want to continue it on the books because of the fact that it is in the Oregon Constitution, that this could be considered by the full commission rather than taking through the subcommittee. So this is appears at the end of your draft. I did want to alert you to the fact that is in there. Okay.
Probably make a misdemeanor and put it in the budget of the defense. Treason against the country.
You can do it.
All right, where are we going?
Page 4 on riot. A person commits the crime of riot if, while participating with 5 or more other persons, he engages in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly creates a grave risk of causing public alarm.
What is the word with?
Very clear.
In concert with, or happens to be where there are 5 other presence. There have to be
necessary to prove the riders were involved in common disorder. Not enough to show that engaged in similar unrelated activities.
So they've been working independently for a common goal.
No, I don't think on the concept of riot. That's more the concept of conspiracy of the Chicago 8. They were all working independently in conspiracy for a common goal, even though they didn't know each other.
5-5.
Well, that will not be very big. The present law is
3.
All right, law is 3. New York has 2 degrees of riot, one involving 10 and the other 4. Connecticut has 2 degrees, 6 and 2.
Do we have any cases going to Portland at all out of the riot?
There's a number of riots.
Are there?
One thing that's pointed out in the commentary is that most prosecutions arising from a riot involve other substantive crimes committed in the riot. Very few people. Studies made in the Watts District, for example, after their problems, showed that out of over 1,000 arrests made, only something like 22 of them were charged with rioting.
And they just couldn't find anything else for the charge of
rioting.
Most of the rest were charged with arson or malicious destruction of property, and assault, battery, and such.
And this does not include inciting the riot, which was, I think, would be probably a criminal solicitation. And that doesn't include failure to disperse, which we have covered in disorderly conduct.
Well, what's your pleasure? When did you want to
go? Too long before the door got to the I move you down to section 2.
Yeah!
Okay, is there a second?
Good law.
Is there a second?
Sure.
Representative Frost, second.
All
right.
I previously used the words tumultuous and violent conduct in reading the commentary. The words used there are terroristic mob behavior involving ominous threats of personal injury and property damage. Let me say terroristic or ominous behavior or something. What is tumultuous?
Yeah, what's tumultuous?
That's kind of a mild little word.
Causing a tumult.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not quarreling with the fact that it'll be in the commentary, and I'm not quarreling with that's as strong as it should be. I think it should be strong. All I'm saying is, couldn't we better use the word? I don't think tumultuous is a word of art that we define in the first place.
No, they were used, those two terms, because they've been traditionally used in higher legislation. There's quite a bit of case law.
Oh, it's true.
Case law.
Does it say that it's escrow?
Does the case law say that it's private?
That's what the Oregon cases say, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is a very strong word. This is a terroristic modification.
Well, this is a more extreme definition than that which is given by Webster. Terroristic and ominous. Webster says, noisy commotion, uproar, confusion, agitation, great emotional disturbance. And here you're talking about terroristic. That's...
You'll note on the bottom of page 8 and top of page 9, there's some examples in the Oregon law that you are to be given of what violent commotion conduct is. 8 or 10 disguised men parading up and down the street at night, shooting guns and blowing horns for several hours.
Well, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, they say, Dave, they say in this one case, it is enough if the action of the parties be so violent and tumultuous as to be likely to cause fright, and if individuals are frightened. You get two dozen people out stomping around and being violent and tumultuous.
Well, you said two.
Ominous terrorism.
You gotta have five.
No, I said a dozen.
Oh.
Well, of course, they
have six.
The disorders that you're trying to get at take all kinds of form.
Hear this talk.
Well, I'm being
overly
tricky, maybe, but...
Well, since we okay. Table that, you're safe.
I agree. I second the motion.
Maybe we should change the commentary.
Went down to 3960. Yeah, but I don't think...
Most of the cases cited here, and in fact, I think all of them, including the Oregon courts, have used this term, violent and tumultuous.
Have they defined them as being terroristic and ominous?
Well, there's one cited on page 9. It's not an Oregon case, a Wisconsin case. Riot is an assembly of individuals who commit a lawful or unlawful act in a violent or tumultuous manner to the terror or disturbance of others.
I think this is a good thing.
Well, this wouldn't change the present law in Oregon as far as what is a riot.
No.
Except the number.
The number of people is different.
It would reduce the population.
Well, how do you know that we're the present law?
Because we say so.
That's my opinion. Any use of force or violence or a threat to use force or violence accompanied by an immediate power of execution.
They put in the commentary that our intent, the prosecutor will use sound discretion.
Except in Benton County.
He's over-exercising his discretion right now.
We have these people tooting the horn in your next election campaign, Johnson. You'll be included.
You have to prove public alarm for that.
No, that's true. And that's pointed out on page 4, the second paragraph. The proposed section adopts a modern concept of a riot by shifting the emphasis from the commission of some other kind to the conduct that creates the risk of causing public alarm. Our present statute, subsection 1, by any use of force or violence would ordinarily be a crime within itself if force or violence were used against the person or property, or the threat to use force or violence.
So then the commentary is wrong?
No, I'm just reminding his question that actually, this changes our present law on riot in a rather substantial
respect. Yeah.
Well,
okay,
now it changes now.
I'm glad you made that concession.
I didn't make a concession. The commentator
did. I'm not so sure I agree with that it changes substantially. You've got more people involved, but 166.040 says, use or threat to use force or violence.
Where is threat to use violence covered in Section 2? You gotta use it, don't you? Or you gotta engage in tumultuous conduct.
That's what threatening is.
Tumultuous and what?
Five people shouting, "I'll kill all of you."
Old law.
There's nothing wrong with it.
I don't say there's anything wrong with it particularly, but I resent the comment that it's a duplicate of the existing law. It doesn't.
It relaxes the existing law. How's that?
I don't know whether it relaxes it or what. I think some elements it's tougher and relaxed. I just think it's
Well, I second the motion that has been made to pass it.
Any further discussion? Call a roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sanderson.
Aye.
Carson.
Oh, no.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Jernstedt.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight. Pauling.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chen.
Aye. I'd like the record to show, here we go, that I do not believe that Section 2 is duplicative of the existing law.
The record will show that.
Well, does the commentary say that someplace?
The Attorney General's opinion is.
I mean, you got that opinion out.
That, we should
quicker.
I don't see that.
Oh, shut up.
Besides, the only way you answer questions now is yes or no. Section 3.
Unlawful assembly. A person commits a crime of unlawful assembly if, one, he assembled with five or more other persons with the purpose of engaging in conduct constituting a riot, or, two, being present at an assembly that either has or develops the purpose of engaging in conduct constituting a riot, he remains there with the intent to advance that purpose. That sub one is very close to our present unlawful assembly statute, which is subsection 2 of ORS 162.040, which does not have a penalty attached to it, so 166.040. So it's state law in Oregon, while we have a statute which defines unlawful assembly, it's not a crime. It's
well, is it normally some sort of a disturbance of the peace or something necessary to constitute an unlawful assembly?
Not an actual disturbance. There has to be an intent or a purpose to do it.
Five fellows together whispering on a street corner.
It's unlawful.
Usual statutes on this.
That's covered by the obscenity statute.
New York women prepare to engage in tumultuous or violent conduct. This is the purpose of engaging in a riot.
That's what they were passing around Molotov cocktail.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, though I'm going to be reluctant to say that this follows the present law, as I understand
it, you're being a little bit more cautious.
The section would essentially carry forward what is the present Oregon law, and they say in this Heffernan's case, unlawful assembly is a distinct offense in common law, and if persons assemble for a purpose which, if executed, would constitute a riot, but separate without carrying out their purposes, their act constitutes an unlawful assembly. In other words, the unlawful assembly is where they get ready and they're assembled, and then for whatever reason it's stopped or discontinued before it actually reaches the riot state. And I understand that theory carries through, that's not, into the wording of the
that was the intent of the section.
That was the intent, Mr. Attorney General.
I find that it is best to derive the intent to express the language of the statute.
We end up.
I second.
After that explanation, you've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion from the. What direction is that?
That's north.
Is it?
Yeah.
North end of the table.
What we're talking about really was the court front.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had much trouble with the north end of the table. I'm not proceeding around.
Halfway
today.
Already?
Call the roll.
We've got a solicitation.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
No.
Frost.
Aye.
Jernstead.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Spalding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Harry.
Are we gonna have a vote?
Section four.
Chairman, I'd like to explain my vote.
Yes.
I tend to agree that probably there would be no prosecutions under this statute as written, and that if it is already covered in other sections, the same conduct, that is probably unnecessary to clutter the order of law.
You mean communications after.
Well, I'm not for unlawful sending.
Comments noted.
Can I, actually, I'd like to ask you a question.
Section three covers.
The only difference is this is the presence at the place.
Yeah.
Solicitation would be someplace else, soliciting or whatever.
Tempting.
This is intent, I think. But you're there. You can't show, the problem I can see, and maybe I'm wrong, is like, the difficulty is showing what they were going to do.
That's right.
Require tumultuous and violent conduct. How do you show they were there for the purpose of engaging in tumultuous and violent conduct unless they engage? It's not like saying, I'm not over a bank, or, because you have a degree, I suppose, that what tumultuous and what.
Section four.
Now, wait a minute. Now, what the hell's the sense of putting a statute in here that we've already covered in another statute?
Well, I think that's the reason why.
I'm not sure we have, though.
Well, it's not covered by an intent, because an intent in a crime requires a substantial step. It would be closer to a conspiracy to riot.
Inciting to riot.
Conspiracy.
Because the substantial step part of our attempt would not reach the type of conduct this is intending to reach.
It's got five people gathered together, especially things for right. The difficulty is showing the quality of the riot they're trying to conspire, because it requires a level of conduct, and it's tumultuous and violent.
But if the under the circumstances, the degree of activity reached should not be a substantial step in the light of the intent framework, then it wouldn't be a tent to cry out.
Well, the tent would probably come out of three guys who get in and say, let's go down to town and throw some Molotov cocktails through Myron Frank's window. And on the way, we're going to stop and pick up Joe and Sam. And we'll start downtown. Now, that might be an attempt, I don't know. But the idea of a substantial step downtown, Molotov cocktail in your pocket, and pick up Joe and Sam to make the necessary fire.
Well, proving that substantial step is no more difficult than proving that a person is engaging in conduct constituting a riot.
Well, I think you're definitely going to be a tip. I think the problem here, though, is the quality of the conduct required. Because you know,
you can prove the purpose of engaging in conduct constituting a riot, I'm sure you'll probably think you're going to be a tip.
Section four.
I'm just thinking of all that printing in the ORS.
I don't think anybody will ever prosecute them.
Under the new one?
Yeah.
Under section three?
Under the section we just voted on.
I'll tell you, if things get real tough and rioting becomes a problem in our state, and we're getting closer and closer to it, I think you'll see perhaps some utilization of that unlawful assembly.
Mr. Chairman, before going on to the next session, I would like to have the chair realize that I have noticed the attempted and overt dispersal of the liberal elements of the commission from the north end of the table.
Yeah, I've observed
that. What does that make me say?
Very strategically relocated the Effete.
Yeah, it might help this one too. If we reported this particular section in our article did not come from Subcommittee 2, if that helps them proceed.
Now, I'd like to go on a record too.
All right, Roger, do you want to go ahead?
Yes.
Section 4, disorderly conduct. A person commits a crime of disorderly conduct if with intent to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, or recklessly creating the risk thereof, he, and this intent applies to all seven subsections, engages in fighting or in violent, tumultuous, or threatening behavior, makes unreasonable noise, uses abusive or obscene language, or makes an obscene gesture in a public place, disturbs any lawful assembly of persons without lawful authority, obstructs vehicular or pedestrian traffic on a public way, congregates with other persons in a public place and refuses to comply with the lawful order of the police to disperse, or our catch-all, creates a hazardous...
What's one of the ones ahead of it?
What I may have missed here. Creates a hazardous or physically offensive condition by any act that serves no legitimate purpose.
Now, I
that's
just have...
That's the unconstitutional.
I just have one question. Do you all want to know who's going to be George Wallace's Attorney General?
This is a little like the CPA that always leaves in the obvious one for the IRS guy to pick up, hoping he'll slip the other six in the pass. Well, we left one in so the court can go to town on it and we'll get the rest of the pass.
It's a fairly comprehensive section.
Starting on page, the bottom of page 20,
no, I think it's quite clear.
Through 22, this would replace approximately 20 to 25 existing statutes.
You mean more than those which you have listed here?
So our present vagrancy statute, subsection F, covers about four of our subsections.
You've got 23 listed here.
Well, I think this is a couple of them. I'd like to change the wording of subsection 7. I'd like to have it read, creates a hazardous, comma, physically, comma, or offensive condition.
Well, that subsection 7 is never going to stand up on a constitutional attack.
No, that's a pretty broad proposition.
I know you'll support the legislature, but...
Sorry, boys.
That's the pronouncement known as an Ipsy Dixit.
Serves no legitimate purpose.
What's a legitimate purpose?
Well, the example I use in the commentary is an Oregon statute, 166.140, the use of stink bombs, which is a felony carrying a 2-year penalty.
It is?
Yeah.
Marked down to 10 until the legislature. A couple of years ago. The theater people in the late 30s.
Is
there? No, I think they were the ones who originally brought up the stink bomb.
Well, now, some of the statutes that you have listed over here on page 22 are covered by our malicious destruction draft.
Right. Tampering with burial property.
Or defacing school property or defacing a building.
I'm glad you're getting rid of that obstructing highway.
Chairman, I have another motion. I suggest in the title up there we strike the first three letters. After section 4 period, we strike the next three letters.
Actually, we're going to write in a section 8 to describe the Attorney General's conduct.
I think it's covered by something
you know, actually...
Oh, that's a 7.
With the exception of number 7, this thing does leave the necessity for a lot of the separate statutes we have. Covers the same situations, perhaps even more inclusive.
Pretty well covers the entire existing criminal code.
That's right.
The bomb shit.
Get this in the Ten Commandments, you got her made.
Well, this even shows covet somewhere.
Well, Mr. Chairman, here again, there's a specific statute for abandoning a refrigerator in a place accessible to children. And this was a very, very important statute when it was passed. Now you say, Roger, that that's going to, seven will take care of that. I think so, because I don't see how you're going to define legitimate purpose.
Well, of course, the other thing.
To whom?
Yes.
Of course, the other thing about it is that refrigerator statute was passed 15 years ago or 17 years ago, and every refrigerator that's been made since then has got a magnetic box.
No, that bill was passed in 65.
Personal vote.
But the refrigerators that are being abandoned now, with very few of them have a magnetic door on them.
Probably 2 4 years.
4 years.
65.
We bought our, we moved into our house in 61 and bought a refrigerator, it's a magnetic lock one. It was after all that trouble in California.
Maybe so.
9 years.
You bought it second hand.
I think we bought it second hand. Probably a 15-year-old.
Well, we've got a couple of them up in the cabin, but they're not magnetic. And lots of people do have it. Soon will be thrown out and deposited.
Roger, couldn't that seven be phrased in such a manner that no one could create a hazardous or a physically dangerous or offensive condition by any act that isn't necessary to the pursuit or the furtherance of some proper effort or work or labor or something in which he's engaged?
I imagine
serves no legitimate
purpose. That's what we intended to say here, because of course the object of it is to protect the, for example, the rendering plant operator.
Now, where did you get the language?
I have another question.
Yes.
Model penal code?
They use language, serves no legitimate purpose of the actor.
Of the actor.
How does this section, suppose you get the wild party going?
Well, this misdemeanor covers it.
How about
unreasonable noise?
Wild party, and but they're not making much noise. Just all winter up against the windows, made obscene gestures. That in public place.
Isn't the real
public place is defined in section one.
What about the intent to cause public inconvenience?
An unnecessary.
By making it obvious.
Well, it causes them to see a public inconvenience.
Well, now, I had a case, where the deputy sheriff, who was kind of hot-headed and thin-skinned, this kid that didn't like him, going down the highway one day, nobody else in the highway, the kid put his hand out the window and made an obscene gesture. So the deputy sheriff got a complaint for disorderly conduct.
Have you read the sign, wave to the cop?
All right. Well, Dale didn't use very good discretion when he issued that complaint, but... Would he, Roger?
No, because disorderly conduct...
Would he be guilty under
here? ...only refers to public annoyance. We get into harassment later, which might be covered under making obscene gesture to harass a particular individual. And in fact, there's more than case on that was actually the conviction was reversed by the Supreme Court on
Wilson versus Parrott?
No, it was her son-in-law, who they lived next door to each other.